So then the Vajrayana, okay, so it started to be called the Vajrayana because the Vajra was a symbol of Indra, who was one of the Vedic storm gods. Okay, so the Vajra symbolized power because it represented a thunderbolt and also a diamond. Okay, so it had those two symbolisms. So it was called the Vajrayana. And so they called the basic Mahayana, you know, what we often call the Paramitayana, they called that the causal vehicle, and they called the Vajrayana the resultant vehicle. The way the Tibetans explain it now is the causal vehicle because you create so much merit and you're laying the foundation of the three principal aspects of the path. And then Vajrayana is the resultant vehicle because you are taking the result as part of your practice, you know, by assuming the, you know, by identifying or by generating your wisdom in the form of a deity, then you're practicing the result. So it's called the resultant vehicle. So some people started saying that the Vajrayana, some Vajrayana texts started saying that the Vajrayana was faster, and then some went even beyond that and said it's the only real path to enlightenment. And again, you find that in Tibetan Buddhists, you know, they'll talk about Vajrayana being faster, but when you get down and you really get into the Vajrayana texts and study the nitty-gritty, it really comes out that at the last moment, even you're a 10th level bodhisattva in the Paramita vehicle, you have to practice Vajrayana to become a Buddha. You know, so there's that view, you know, nowadays also. Okay, Vajrayana was also called Mantrayana because of the recitation of these mantras. And the idea was, and again, that, you know, that you, through... The words derive power from emptiness. And so, and this is the way the scholars were describing it. So through this meditation on emptiness and imbuing the words with powers, therefore you could coerce deities and other beings to do what you wanted them to do. So, you know how much Buddhist tantrics did thought like that? It's really hard to say. I mean, definitely the non-Buddhists did, because, you know, it was quite a powerful thing. But how much the Buddhists did, you know, there was probably people who practiced very purely and people who didn't. You know, it's kind of like that everywhere. Okay, but a lot of the scholars, their understanding of tantra is skewed. Yeah. Anyway, there were different interpretations of what tantra meant. And even in India, I found this interesting, there was an 8th century commentary that that formed three kinds of tantras. So there were Kriya, Charya, and Yoga tantras. Yes, this division goes back to India. Then there was a 12th century text that divided the yoga into yoga, yogotara, so higher yoga, and yoga anirutara, or unexcelled. Okay? And then later the Tibetans combined the last two there into anuttara yoga. Yeah, so there's something happening there. But the Kriya texts, okay, the Kriya tantras were basically the sutras that had dharanis in them. So this is what I was saying yesterday, or a few days ago, like the Medicine Buddha practice, or the Kuan Yin practice, or the, you know, Amitabha practice, how these were called sutras in Chinese Buddhism, but in Tibetan Buddhism they became tantras. So here maybe is the link, that the Kriya tantras were basically these kind of Mahayana sutras with dharanis in them, okay? And it's interesting because it seems that, okay, so many scholars said that they're sutras and they're not tantras. Many of them appeared prior to the 8th century, Okay, so they were very early on. They, you know, came in the flourishing of the Mahayana, some as early as the 3rd century. And most of them did not involve assuming the identity of the deity. Okay? And that's what I find is very interesting in most of the Kriya Tantra practices that we do now, because most of them, they're jhanas, aren't they? And you do the front generation practice of the deity. And so that's what we're doing here, you know, because people haven't had initiation by and large, you know, and guests and everything. So we always do the front generation of the deity. So in the Tibetans, that's Kriya Tantra. In the Chinese, it's just Mahayana, you know, the Amitabha Sutra or the Kuan Yin Sutra or whatever. It's interesting that for Chenrezig, Thousand Arm Chenrezig, there's the Wong, there's the actual initiation, the 2-day thing. But I haven't really heard of 2-day Wongs, or should I put it this way, I've never attended a 2-day Wong for any other Kriya Tantra deity. Have you? You know? It's always Chenrezig. And even in like the Nagi Salam text, you know, they always use Chenrezig as an example, and generating yourself as the deity, they use Chenrezig. Okay? So at least in the Thousand Arm Chenrezig, there is that self-generation practice, and that's the retreat we're going to be doing this coming winter. Okay, so in the Tibetan, you know, Thousand Arm Chenrezig, there is a self-generation, but it seems like in a lot of the others, there isn't. Okay, then Charya Tantra. Kriya is action tantra, Charya is performance. So the initiate identifies with Vairochana, who's the cosmic Buddha, from the Gandavyuha and the Dasabhumika Sutras. You know, that those two sutras, which are general Mahayana sutras, identified Vairochana as embodied in the universe. And so the initiate takes on the enlightened views of the cosmos as embodied by Vairochana. Okay? Then Yoga Tantra, there you identify with Vairochana, but you go further, and the ritual is not only for worldly powers, according to these Western scholars, you know, but also of gaining Buddhahood. Okay. And in the 7th and 8th century, there was a text which established the Vajradhatu Mandala with Vairochana in the center and the other Buddhas around. And so, you know, you have Vairochana in the center and the four Buddhas around, so there you get the 5 Buddha families. And this kind of mandala structure replicated the political theory of the time, because there was a king in the center with his retinues all around, okay? And then outside of that, protectors, yeah? So very much like kind of corresponded with some of the political philosophy at the time. Kind of George Bush, you know, Donald Rumsford in the East, and Condoleezza Rice in the South, and, you know, John Roberts, who's the Supreme Court judge in the, you know, in the West, and who else, you know. So kind of like that, you know, sort of so then you could see again how it, you know, in one way you could say it's just a skillful transformation of all these worldly things. In another way, somebody could look at it and say it's bringing worldly things into a spiritual practice and degeneration. So you could see how, you know, different people would have different reactions to Tantra over the ages, and that's exactly what's happened. People have had very, very different reactions to it. This Vairochana practice became, and Vajradhatu Mandala practice became very, very popular in Japan, and it's the two major tantric practices there in the Shingon tradition. And it's interesting, if you go to a Shingon temple, they do fire pujas. You know, there's so much similar to what the Tibetans do. Okay. Then you had the Mahayoga tantras. Okay, and so these really brought in a few changes, and these became very popular after the 8th century. Okay, first of all, you had the fierce element, so you had, you know, many more wrathful deities, okay? Kind of the wrathful deity really became emphasized here. And you, in the 8th century, became, you know, you really had the promulgation of the Guru Samaja Tantra with Akshobhya in the center. Akshobhya is from the Vajra family, so the Vajra is the symbol of power and, you know, the thunderbolt and everything. So instead of peaceful Vairochana in the center, now it's, you know, Akshobhya, powerful Akshobhya in the center in the Guru Samaja. Okay, then other changes you had in Mahayoga Tantra is now the deities are in sexual union, you know, representing method and wisdom, representing the great bliss. But again, wow, you know, what a possibility for people to have to misunderstand. And then there seemed to be more involvement of women in this kind of Tantra. And the initiation involves sexual union with a partner from another caste, the consumption of forbidden and impure substances, even human flesh. Okay? Now, okay, and the purpose of this was to tap into the power of the forbidden, because, you know, whatever is forbidden always has a lot of power, and to also eliminate dualistic thinking in people's minds. Now, What I'm curious about is, and it actually, there seem to be two different ways of monastic, of, you know, like, because you have the whole monastic institutions, how are they interpreting this kind of stuff? So there seem to be two different ways. One way is saying that the substances were symbolic, okay? And that's the view that you have now. You know, at least in the Galupa. I don't know so much about the other ones, but, you know, at least, you know, I think most of the other ones that say to, it's just I haven't studied them, you know, that all the substances are symbolic. But then it just seems like also in ancient India, there was another school of thought saying, no, you use the actual substances because you use the actual substances, it was extremely important to keep all of this secret. So it was only passed down orally, and the initiations were very quiet and stuff like this. The reason I said that about the Tibetan traditions is I remember once hearing a teaching, you know, where they really emphasized, because maybe it was that when Buddhism, or, you know, Tantric Buddhism first came to Tibet, maybe they were using actual substances, I'm not sure. But in this teaching, the Lama really emphasized, you know, no, these are all symbolic. And, you know, because like when you make blessed pills, or even your inner offering pills, yeah, you don't use the actual, you know, when you do an inner offering, you visualize all these different kinds of meats and nectars and things like that. But, and you put a little pill inside some, you know, some fluid. But the substances, the pill, are not the actual kinds of meats. They're just different things that are symbolic of them. So that was really stressed in that, in the teaching that I received on that. So it could have been that, you know, maybe before there was some degeneration and people were using the actual things, and so that's why it's really emphasized.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was studying this commentary by Nilshu Dharmavadra, and he basically said that, like, in the past, all the tantric practitioners were qualified enough that they could actually transform it, but nowadays, that it's degenerate, they can't use the actual substances because the people don't have the power to actually transform.
So. Yeah. Yeah, and what would transform it would actually be the meditation on emptiness. Yeah. Okay, so beginning in the 9th century, then the Mahayoga became very, very prominent, and they really embraced the Siddha ideal. And so here's the time when you have people like Naropa, you know, coming in. And the story in Naropa was abbot of Nalanda and then, you know, became a siddha and things like that. And you have all these hagiographies, which, if you don't know what hagiography means, it means an idealized biography. It's a biography that's told from the viewpoint of how will it benefit the reader. So it's not necessarily something that tells the whole story of what went on. So you have these incredible hagiographies. And the one of the 84 cities that is siddhas, it's been translated into English. So there's stories like that. But the siddhas, there were, I think, two women in them. There were people from all different castes, because one element of, some of the important elements of Tantra was really going beyond, you know, basic societal conventions. So here you have this Indian rigid caste system, yeah, where you can't even like use the same water fountain as certain people. And lower castes were like really trashed, and to some extent they still are. Yeah, despite of everything Gandhi did. Yeah. So here you have this rigid caste system, and Tantra comes in and says, doesn't matter, you know, you can hang out with anybody. So it like was really against like, you know, societal conventions. So Tantra was really, you know, did a lot of that. There was a lot of this thing of, you know, eating meat, drinking alcohol. And you have to understand the context here, which Westerners don't. Okay. So first of all, within tantric practice, or at least Buddhist tantra practice, you know, there's an emphasis on working with the channels, winds, and drops of the subtle body. So to keep the body strong and to keep these elements strong so that you can manipulate them and generate this extremely subtle consciousness and realize emptiness with this extremely subtle consciousness, which quickly clears away defilements. In order to do that, then eating meat and drinking some alcohol helps to keep these elements of the body strong, and you need those elements to do the practice, okay? So that's why those things are permitted for people who are at that actual level of practice where they can do that, okay? So, you know, it means here on the completion stage practice, you have renunciation, bodhicitta, correct view of emptiness. You know how to deal with all your channels, winds, and drops. And you need to keep them strong, okay? And you also have full samadhi through the generation stage practice. Okay, so these are like pretty high practitioners. Now, so first of all, there's a reason for doing it within the actual thing of what happens with your body. There's another reason for doing this in the sense of overcoming societal taboos. And in a very strict Brahmin society, you're not allowed to eat meat. You're not allowed to drink. Okay? Yeah. Then the Brahmins were the highest caste. So these were the people that everybody respected and wanted to be like. So here you are, you're drinking and eating meat, and you're acting totally the opposite of the Brahmas, which were the highest caste and the most respected and what everybody wanted to be. So you can see how that helps people overcome this kind of, you know, rank and prestige and inherently existent birth power and stuff like that. Okay. Also, you know, if there were monastics who were training in this, not the monastics, in Mahayana Buddhism, in many of the Mahayana scriptures, it was really emphasized to be vegetarian. And of course, not drinking is a standard Buddhist precept across the board. So if you had people who had been training for years and years to give up their attachment to meat, and they finally had given up their attachment to meat. There are people who are training to give their attachment to alcohol up, and now they've finally given that up. And maybe within those people, some of them might have a tendency to become a little bit arrogant. You know how even nowadays we meet born-again vegetarians or born-again vegans, you know, people just want to cram it down your throat about how pure they are because they eat this and this and this. So you can see that if there was the tendency of some people to go to that extreme of being a little bit proud because they didn't eat meat and didn't drink, well, to cut their pride, what do? You have a practice where you do the very opposite. Okay? For Westerners who are very attached to eating meat, very attached to drinking, there's nothing about overcoming you don't have to overcome any conceit. You don't have to overcome any dualistic way of thinking in order to eat meat and drink alcohol. You just have to do what you've been doing all along, except now you say, oh, it's a high practice. Are you getting what I'm saying? You know? So you can see how in a society with certain taboos, then if you wanted to cut dualistic practice, you would give this kind of thing. But that doesn't fit our social situation at all. Okay? Similarly, when you have in Tantra, the consort practice, okay? It has nothing at all to do with ordinary sex. And there's all these precepts about who your partner is supposed to be, how you're supposed to think, and if you break any of these precepts, it's like really heavy negative karma. So again, it's for people who are on the completion stage of single point of concentration, of renunciation, bodhicitta, and right view, and they're doing it completely for the purpose of, you know, getting all the winds in the central channel so that they can attain enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings. Okay, so that's why there's the consort practice. Now in America, you know, well, I don't know, maybe these people are all high yogis and yoginis, who am I to say anything? But for average Joe Blow, and if we assume there's a few of them hanging around, you know, because most of these people, before they become tantric practitioners, like Naroka, he's celibate. Okay, he's been celibate for years. He doesn't drink for years. Yeah. So then again, you know, this kind of overturning of, in case you began to grasp your morality is inherently existent, in case you began to get conceited about your morality, then there's this flip thing. Okay? So there's a reason for doing that practice in terms of the generation stage and dealing with the body, and then there's the reason in order to break concept. But if you take the average Westerner, where there's been no renunciation of sexual conduct, you know, no renunciation of eating meat or drinking, and then say, well, I'm doing all this stuff because I'm a tantric practitioner, it's not really fulfilling the purposes for which those things were designed. Okay? So you can see why so much, you know, that the Tantra was really not publicly distributed because, you know, so much opportunity for misunderstanding amongst people. Okay. What was interesting in some of these hagiographies is that some of them are different, how they talk about them. And they were saying that according to one Kargyu account, Naropa is a Bengali Brahmin. But in an Indian account from the 11th century by Abhayadattasri, it says that Naropa was a Kashmiri woodcutter. So it's like, you know, not all these hagiographies match up, but in most of them, there's an incredible emphasis on, incredible devotion to the spiritual mentor, to taking the risk of social censure, to disregarding social conventions. Okay, so this was also going on with the Shivite Tantra, you know, this whole movement and, you know, Tantra all over India. They were all involved with these things. Okay, like I was explaining the other day in Buddhist Tantra, that, you know, the emphasis on seeing the guru as the Buddha is just because you're training your mind to see the environment as a pure land and everybody in it also as a deity. So of course you're not going to leave your spiritual mentor out of that. Yeah. And you read, we've talked about this before, you know, these stories of, you know, Naropa and Talopa and Milarepa and Marpa. And, you know, these are practitioners of just incredible quality. I mean, with great, great spiritual realizations. So when you see how they followed their gurus, and their gurus kind of sometimes told them to do these really outlandish things. I mean, there's one story about, I think it was Talopa, and there was a wedding going on, and Talopa said to Naropa, go take the bride. And Naropa went and took the bride. Okay? You know, there's another story of Talopa kind of standing on the edge of a cliff and saying, if I had a real disciple, he'd jump over the cliff. And Naropa did and fell down and broke all his bones, and Talopa went down there and patched him up again. You know, Humpty Dumpty got fixed up. But, you know, like His Holiness says, if you're that quality of disciple like Naropa, and your teacher's the quality of disciple like Talopa, then this kind of, you know, devotion that is very difficult for us ordinary beings to understand is quite appropriate. Yeah. But for ordinary beings who don't have those realizations, this kind of blind thing of, well, you know, it's just, and this is how all these scandals happened in the 90s, you know? So, again, you know, we really have to understand things properly and how they work, and not just be quite blind in the whole thing. Okay, so then, from the what was the relationship between this tantric movement and the monastics? Well, from the very beginning, there were some monastics who were writing commentaries to the tantras. But there seemed to be kind of four different views on how the monastics should relate to the tantras. So some of the monastics said, this is a corruption of Buddhism. Stay away from it. It has nothing to do with Buddhism. So those were the Staviravadas. And you can see that this view now, like in the Theravada tradition, you know, because there's all this misunderstanding, and, you know, Tibetans and the Chinese to some extent, I mean, they don't always think very highly of the Tibetans either. They, you know, unless they want some magical powers, and then they want the Tibetan lamas to come and do pujas to do magic. Okay? So, you know, there's all these centuries of, you know, misunderstanding going on here. But, you know, at that time also, there were some monastics who said, look, it's not Buddhist, stay away. Then there's other people like Lama Atisha. And I found this quite interesting. And I'd like to check it from a Tibetan source too. But Lama Atisha said that the sexual element in the initiation was important. And for that reason, monastics can't participate in it. Okay, so he understood Tantra. He himself was a monk, you know, but he said that monastics can't participate in the initiation process, though they could teach Tantric texts and do rituals that didn't compromise their precepts, which is interesting. Then there's a third position of monastics, and people like Munidatta, this was his view, and he said this, the actual sexual element in the initiation is not important, it's symbolic, so the monastics could use a knowledge consort or a jhana mudra and not an actual action consort or karma mudra. And in fact, Munidatta said that the knowledge consort was superior. So this is the view that you have very much throughout the Tibetan tradition right now, where the monastics use the knowledge consort, which means a visualized consort. There's no actual sexual engagement. And then there's people like Abhayakara Gupta. He was from the 11th century, and he said the sexual aspect was important to the initiation, and the monastics could participate as long as they had the proper understanding of emptiness. Okay? So there might be some traces of that within the Tibetan tradition too. Of course, having the proper understanding of emptiness is pretty high realization. So all these views had adherence in India, and, you know, at least three of them have adherence in Tibet. In terms of the role of Tantra, some texts say that the role of women in Tantra, some say that women taught and practiced the Tantras. And it's said that Naropa has had more female disciples than male disciples, which I found interesting. But the Tantras, when you look at them, the whole description is according to the male body. Okay. And so there's all this elaborate etiquette and so on for respecting women. But this particular author said that it could, you know, be in some ways a disguise or something that also could lead to some oppression. Yeah. And again, you know, if there's degeneration, if there's corruption, well, we've seen it even nowadays, haven't we? You know? Who knows what realizations certain people have, but then taking, you know, consorts who don't have those kinds of realizations. Okay. In any case, the Pala period was not supportive of the nuns. And actually, the nuns, they seem to kind of peter out in the later, years in India. I think, you know, a lot of it could have been because there was so much financial struggle, you know, for all the monasteries, and as we all know, the monks always get more than the nuns do. And then I found this very interesting, and again, I'd like to check it with the Tibetan view, the standard Tibetan view. They were saying that others denounce the tantras and the mantras and espouse completely spontaneous action, and they were called the Sahajayana. Sahajayana, okay? The spontaneous vehicle. And people like Saraha was an example of this. And these people denounced the siddhas for lacking a Buddhist understanding because they said that these siddhas lack compassion in their pursuit for power and that they were attached to the mantras and the tantras. So I found this kind of interesting, that even way back in ancient India, there was a split here of people kind of even criticizing the Buddhist tantricas. But eventually, this Sahajayana got incorporated back into Vajrayana. But I found that quite interesting.